Oscar Scafidi holds the Guinness World Record for kayaking down Angola's longest river, is a history teacher and has researched piracy in Somalia, and is also a travel writer and a political risk and security consultant. This is Oscar Scafidi. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank.
All right. I'm here with Oscar Scafidi. Oscar, thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I wanted to talk to you because you are a professional travel writer, and I want to start right there because you've gone all over the world to some pretty hazardous situations. There wasn't some website that you signed up for this on, was there? I mean, how did you make your way into doing this for a living?
No, there was nowhere that I signed up for this. So it started out simply as personal interest. So I love to travel, and in particular, I like traveling to lesser visited destinations in kind of Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. And I always used to write about my travels free of charge for many years for various specialist websites and publications. And then off the back of that, I started getting paid. It was quite a long process from turning it from a hobby into an actual career.
Right. I had talked to another travel writer, Richard Grant. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he said that he was just traveling and sending letters back to his friends. People are like, you got to publish these things. I mean, when you're going to places, I mean, some of the places that you've gone, like Angola, Somalia, Afghanistan, these are, as you mentioned, very seldom traveled to, at least by Westerners. What made you feel prepared to be able to go into these situations?
Well, those three are all slightly different. So one of the other jobs that I have done in the past is I'm a history teacher. So I qualified as a history teacher in the UK about 13, 14 years ago. And I knew that I wasn't really that interested in teaching in the UK. So I got qualified as a teacher so I could teach abroad. And in 2009, I took a job teaching history in Angola. So the reason I first went out to Angola was not actually for travel writing. It was to go and teach at Luanda International School in the capital city of Luanda.
Mm. Okay, I gotcha. And so let's talk about Angola then. I had a friend who spent a year in Uganda, and we were all amazed that he did it. And, you know, he talked about points when it was hard and so on. But it was ultimately a good experience. You spent, I believe, 5 years in Angola. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, 2009 to 2014.
Did you know you were going to be spending 5 years there before you signed up?
No, I didn't. I knew I was going to spend at least 2 years there. So the way international teaching works is you tend to sign an initial two-year contract, and then you move on to rolling one-year contracts because it's quite an expensive process relocating someone into a new country. So they want to make sure they get their money's worth by signing you up for at least 2 years. But I knew before going, I was probably going to stay more than 2 years because I had read a book about Angola, which kind of got me interested in the history of the place. And I was very keen to learn to speak Portuguese. So those two things combined quite nicely when I got the job offer in 2009.
I mean, had you done anything like that before, like an extended period of time? Multiple years in another country living there?
No, although I did come up with this crazy plan of moving to Angola when I was actually living in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan.
Okay.
So after university, I graduated, I did history at university. I'd never actually been outside Europe before I graduated from university for my undergrad degree. And I saw a job offer, which was teaching in Sudan. On one of the university careers notice boards. And I'm not sure what the thought process was back then, because this was back in 2006 or 2007, I think. But I thought it sounded interesting. So I signed up and I went off for a year to Sudan. And it was that experience of living in a very different culture to my own that made me think, well, this is what I want to do for a living. I want to live and work in different places.
Sudan has had brushes with civil war and violence. What was it like at the time when you went to live there? I mean, was it not just the culture shock, but was it at all unsafe?
No, not at all. Sudan is the first African country I ever went to. I think I've subsequently been to 30 countries, and I can safely say that Sudan was Khartoum the city where we lived was the safest place in Africa that I've lived.
Really?
There was absolutely no issues. I mean, the situation might have changed a bit today, I don't know. But back then, back when we were there, no issues whatsoever. You could walk the streets at night with no problems. All the street vendors would leave all of their wares laid out on the street just with a cloth over them and go home overnight. No worries about things getting stolen. Everyone was extremely friendly. I suppose the perception is there'd be some sort of anti-Western sentiment. You know, I mean, Sudan at one stage was harboring Osama bin Laden. There's a lot of concerns when people read about Sudan about links to Islamist terrorism, that kind of thing, but nothing like that. We never felt unsafe and we never felt unwelcomed.
Right. Well, I believe, this is U.S. news, but I believe Sudan is one of the countries that's now going to be put on the updated travel ban for the U.S. Oh. So it is interesting to hear people who have lived there have their perspective on it. So you went after that experience. You had experience spending time in Africa, and you wanted to go to Angola. I have to ask, as you're from the UK, correct?
Well, I was originally born and grew up in Italy, so I'm a dual national. But yeah, I did most of my education in the UK, and my mum's British.
Gotcha. Was there at all a feeling of, because obviously the UK is a huge history of colonialism in Africa. Did you at all, I don't know if the word is uncomfortable feeling, or did you feel you didn't want to be like voyeuristic or anything like that? I mean, how did you, was that something that was conscious in your mind?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm a historian by training and I teach history. I teach African history to my students. And one of the things that attracted me about going to Sudan and also about many of the other places in Africa that I've been to is the colonial history. So I find that particular aspect of history fascinating. So there's always this kind of, before I moved to Sudan, there's a bit of concern, like how was I going to be treated when people realized I was British? Well, is there going to be some sort of simmering resentment at the way the British colonial forces treated Sudanese, 100 years ago? But actually everyone was super excited when they heard you're British and very keen to show you that they spoke perfect English. And in a lot of cases, especially with the older generations, keen to talk to you about their experiences of colonialism and their experiences of going to the UK during colonial times and that kind of thing. So yeah, it definitely wasn't what I was expecting.
Were any of the older people's experiences enlightening? I know you're a student of history.
I don't know. Yeah, I suppose they were. Yeah, I was really surprised in Sudan at the general positive attitude towards the British. That was the biggest thing that stood out for me. I would have thought that they would, generally speaking, have a negative view towards the British and especially British colonial times. But a lot of the people that I spoke to, especially those that had been sent for military training back in the UK, I'd bump into all sorts of older gentlemen who got sent back to the UK to do pilots training or all these other kind of training. And it was really interesting to hear them talk fondly of their time in London and their time training in the UK.
Yeah, that's I had a friend go to Vietnam, and obviously the US had terrible war in Vietnam and was expecting a lot of anti-US sentiment. And they were like, listen, dude, we've had plenty of enemies since you guys. So we've kind of moved past it at this point. I want to get back to your time in Angola, because you were part of the team that set the Guinness World Record for the fastest time across Angola's longest river. How did you get involved in that?
So I left Angola in 2014 and moved back to London. But my friend Alfie, who I'd met while I was out there, he was still living there. And he found out that he was going to be leaving the country in 2016. And he knew that he was going to have a gap between finishing work in Angola and starting work in Hong Kong. So he had this kind of 2.5-3 month gap, and he wasn't sure what to do with it. But being a keen outdoorsman, he came up with this crazy idea of, let's do a huge expedition and see if we can kayak the length of the Kwanza River, which is the longest river in Angola. And I think I was the only person Well, he called me immediately because he knew I'd be the only person stupid enough to say yes to him. So it was all Alfie's idea. He cooked up the whole scheme.
Okay. And you had done this, though, in partnership with a group called the Halo Trust. Can you talk a little bit about what they do?
Yeah, that's right. So the Halo Trust are the world's largest and oldest humanitarian landmine clearance organization. So we thought very early on in the process, if we're going to do this, it's going to get some attention, or we assumed it would get some attention because it's a bit unusual, we might as well use some of that attention for a positive cause. And the Halo Trust do a lot of work in Angola. I had a friend who actually worked for them in Angola. Angola is one of the most landmine affected countries in the world, sadly. So we thought, okay, let's try and raise some money for them to clear landmines in the south of Angola.
When you say landmine affected, I mean, that almost, who put these landmines there?
A whole mixture of different people. So Angola, the Angolans fought against the Portuguese for a good few years. And then when they got their independence in 1975, they started fighting each other for control. So they had a civil war from 1975 till 2002. So big, long civil war. And in that time, a lot of people laid landmines. It turned into a bit of a proxy war for the Cold War. So we had Russians sending military advisors in. You had Cuban troops in there, South African troops in there. At the Chinese selling people landmines, all sorts. So a whole collection of different people responsible for those landmines.
A medley, if you will.
Yeah, sadly.
Okay, so on the river, you had spoken about this being one of the more dangerous episodes in your travels, where you have these hippos who, you know, we sitting here in America, a hippo is kind of almost like a Disney cartoon animal. It seems cute and or something you can, you know, take a picture of. But these were real animals present in your life, and they were scary, right?
Yeah, we didn't really think too much about them at the beginning of the trip because there's very little data for hippo numbers on that river, especially in the upper stretches, because it's just a really unexplored part of the country. So we thought a bit more about the more typical dangers. So we started thinking about crocodiles and that kind of thing. But we did speak to a few people about hippos, and what they told us wasn't very encouraging. So they explained exactly how dangerous they are, how fast they can swim, how fast they can run, and how territorial and aggressive they are. So we kind of went out there understanding the risks, but hoping that we weren't going to bump into any. And unfortunately for us, that isn't the way it worked out. We saw a lot of hippos over the course of our trip.
And how did you have to defend yourself at all?
Well, there's not much defending yourself, unfortunately. there's just staying out of their way, basically. Yeah. We did randomly talk about getting a rifle at the beginning of the journey, but everyone we spoke to, all the hunters, said that would be totally useless. Hippos are pretty much bulletproof because of the thickness of their blubber. And they're underwater until just before they knock you out of a kayak. So a rifle would be too little too late if we had one. Yeah. So in the end, we just had to follow advice and give them, you know, make sure we didn't startle them, make sure we didn't come between them and their children, and always make sure they knew where we were and give them as wide a berth as possible.
Wow. I mean, were there any close calls?
Yeah, we had a few close calls. I managed to record one close call on my GoPro, actually, and it ended up in our documentary film. We were finishing up for the night. So we kayaked. We tried to use as much of the daylight as possible for kayaking. So we start at sunrise and try and be off the river by sunset because it gets dangerous if you can't see. Mm-hmm. And it was getting late. Sun was going down. We were looking around for a spot to camp. And we saw two rocks in the center of the river, and then just past the rocks, we saw a really nice area of flat ground, which is perfect. So we were always looking for flat ground to camp on and a shallow bank so that we could pull the kayak out of the water. So we kind of headed straight towards the two rocks, and then we're going to cut in between them and go over onto this bank. And a sort of a few hundred meters before the rocks, we heard this random shout from up in a tree, and it was this Angolan man who had climbed the tree to warn us. And he was essentially telling us that they weren't rocks, those were hippos.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's very lucky. I mean, I don't think we'd seen anyone all day, and we didn't see him until he shouted. I've got no idea where he came from, but it's very lucky he shouted at us, because otherwise we would have gone right in the middle and probably got knocked out the boat by the hippos.
Knocked out the boat. I mean, if one of them, I don't know how a hippo attacks, but they're like a tank underwater, as you said, bulletproof. If one of them took a swipe at you, is it like a bear that you're just done?
Yeah, I think, I mean, they've got big tusks. Both of those hippos had a past track record of attacking many villagers in their boats. So they're aggressive towards humans.
They're known offenders.
Yeah, they're known offenders, yeah. They kill a lot of people every year in Africa. So, yeah, you'd be in a lot of trouble if you got knocked out of your boat with hippos in the water.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, is the relationship to nature. Was it at all different for people? I mean, I imagine it must have been. But I had a friend, as I mentioned, in Uganda, and their big problem was elephants. And we think of elephants as these majestic creatures, but people in Uganda hated them because they would trample their crops.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
It's a very up-close and personal view of nature. Did that resonate with you at all, being a British fellow?
I think it was one of the most enlightening aspects of the trip was getting to talk to people who lived along the river in very, very isolated rural communities and see how they interacted with the river and how important it was for their well-being. So they're essentially all either subsistence farmers or fishermen. And the fishermen especially, I mean, these guys were punting up and down the shallow parts of the river through the reeds, which is exactly where the hippos like to live. And all they had was a big stick, and that was it. You know, and most of the guys we spoke to had either been attacked themselves by a hippo or had stories of friends being attacked and killed or drowning because of hippos. And yet that was just a constant feature of their life. And they just understood that as a hazard of the business because there's no getting around it. They had to go to the river, they had to go fishing, and this was the only boating equipment they had. So they were completely vulnerable to the hippos. But it's really interesting to see the kind of acceptance of that situation and the acceptance of that day-to-day danger. And they didn't seem to be that annoyed with the hippos. They just, you know, there was no malice towards them. They just understood that that's what hippos do, and they need to be as careful as possible not to disturb them.
Yeah, it reminds me of something a philosophy professor had said one time back in school. There was a report of a tiger that broke out of a zoo, and it went berserk and killed two people in some town square. This is in a city in America, and he's like, no, like the tiger tigered, like that's exactly what they do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we can't be. Can't get annoyed for them for doing what they do innately.
Exactly. How did you train for this feat? I mean, it's a pretty physically exhausting task, I imagine.
Well, Alfie and I trained a little bit differently because Alfie was still in Angola, whereas I was in London. So we both tried to do as much kayaking as possible. Alfie got to do it in the boat that we would then use, and he got to do it on the Kwanza River, which is quite good. Whereas I had to do it on the River Thames in the center of London. So I was slightly colder than him and at slightly more risk because that's a very busy waterway. So there's all sorts of boats and transport and things shooting up and down there. But yeah, we tried to get as much kayaking in as possible was the first thing.
Is that meant for kayaking? I didn't know people could do that.
I didn't know people could do it either, but I wrote to a bunch. I was not expecting to do that, but I wrote to a bunch of kayaking clubs around London and said, this is what I'm doing. Can you help me? And these guys, the London Kayak Company, got back to me and said, yeah, we'll help you out. Come join us. But I didn't realize it was going to be on the Thames River until they told me we're going up and down the Thames in central London. So, yeah, you don't need a license. You don't need any qualifications. You just need a boat and off you go.
Oh, boy, that's enough information to be dangerous. okay, I've got to ask you about Somalia. My impression of Somalia, it's probably very limited. But my impression is that it's one of the most anarchic countries in the world, that like law and order is basically just broken down. You got all these pirates running around. I mean, is that impression generally accurate, or have I been misled?
Well, I think it's accurate to a certain extent in certain parts of Somalia. So Somalia is essentially three different countries, although the federal government wouldn't appreciate me saying that. So in the Northwest, you have what's called Somaliland, which was formerly the British colony. And that is, I mean, that's de facto independent. So they have a capital of Hargeisa, they share a big border with Ethiopia, and that is the safest bit of Somalia. But, you know, by most measures, that's a functional state, and that's not dangerous. So whenever people want to say they've been to Somalia, they go to Somaliland. So they cross over the border into Somaliland, and then they take a bunch of photos. It's all good.
Take two steps over the border. I made it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you go slightly further east, I guess Somalia is shaped like a seven. If you go to the sharp pointy bit that goes around the corner, that's called Puntland. And that is a lot less safe. So that is the area that all the pirates are from. So back in the day, up until about 2012, 2013, that is where all of the piracy on the Indian Ocean was based. So the pirates kind of had control of big stretches of the coastline there. They go out, hijack these ships, bring them back to port and charge these extortionate ransoms. That's calmed down slightly in the past few years, but that's still quite an anarchic part of Somalia. And then you go all the way down south where the capital city Mogadishu is, and that's sort of Somalia proper. And yeah, that's probably the most dangerous part of the country, because that large sections of that area are controlled by Al-Shabaab, which is a terrorist group. So yeah, I'd say two of the three sections of Somalia are quite similar to how most people imagine it is.
And which parts did you spend time in?
So I did all three. Okay. So I went into Somaliland because it's the easiest way of doing things. So I actually drove over from Ethiopia. And then from the capital, Hargeisa, I then flew into Puntland. And then we made our way down driving to various areas of Puntland and then across into actual Somalia.
And I believe you had mentioned this was part of your master's thesis?
Well, yeah, yes and no. I definitely wouldn't have gotten permission to go and do this as part of my master's thesis, but I decided I was going to go and do it anyway. So I was writing my dissertation on piracy in Somalia, and I thought it was a bit ridiculous to be doing that without going to Somalia and seeing if I could do some on the ground research. So yeah, it was highly useful in my master's process, but that's not the only reason that I went. I also went because I just wanted to go for personal reasons.
I love that though, because there are so many people who are in graduate school who, you know, they would never even think of going to Somalia in this case. I mean, at that point you had been, had you been to Sudan at that point? You've been to Angola?
Yeah, I'd lived in, so this was, I went from Angola actually. So yeah, I'd been in Angola for 3 years by that stage. And okay. This was kind of how I spent one of my holidays, went to Somalia.
I see. So you had enough confidence to be able to do this. Did you go on your own or did you go with people?
I went on my own. So it took quite a long time to organize. Well, I mean, obviously, I had people on the ground helping me once I arrived, but I was the only one who went. Okay. And it took about three or four months to organize, because there's a lot of logistics that goes into it in terms of security.
Well, okay, so I'm just fascinated. What attracts you to these kinds of? I mean, when you went into Somalia, did you have any expectation that this was going to be? Could get life or death at some point. I mean, I know that there was, you mentioned an incident of a running gun battle that broke out outside your compound one night. Did you ever feel that your life was in danger?
Well, I mean, sections of it were dangerous, yeah. So we went to Galkayo, which is one of the least stable cities in the country. So Galkayo sits right on the border between, you know, the northern part of the city is essentially in Puntland and the southern part is in Somalia. And it's kind of divided down the middle, and there's a lot of warfare essentially between the different groups that live in the different parts of the city for control of the city. So I knew before going that was going to be kind of dangerous. Yeah. But I mean, nothing that I didn't expect having done my research.
Right. That particular gun battle, was that noteworthy in your experience down there, or was that, you know, just...
That was, I mean, I took my cue from the guys that I was with. So I was with a bunch of security guys, and I had my fixer with me.
Your fixer?
My fixer, yeah, my fixer Mohammed, who was looking after you, after me.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty standard. Those guys just sat there chewing cat and chatting, and it didn't faze them. So it told me how normalized it was, the violence on the streets there.
What'd you say they were chewing?
Cat, K-H-A-T. It's a it's a leaf. It's like a stimulant leaf that people like to chew in East Africa.
Okay.
It's kind of, I don't really like it, but if you, people say it's a bit like drinking a few Red Bulls.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and in a country where there's not sort of, people don't have a lot of access to food, it's quite useful because it keeps you awake and it suppresses your appetite, that kind of thing. And it can get quite addictive.
Yeah. That, I mean, I've only heard it mentioned once, but I had heard it mentioned as something that's kind of like a speedy and not like a Red Bull. Is that?
Yeah. I think if you chew enough, it can definitely get quite speedy. Yeah, some of the guys I was with looked like they chewed far too much.
Oh, yeah. That's did that after, like, when that gun battle was breaking out, and the people around you are just chilling, are you thinking in your head like, all right, if these guys think it's okay, then it's probably okay? Or were you at all? Did your adrenaline spike in any way?
Yeah, it was kind of tense for a while, especially as you could hear quite easily how far away or close things were happening. But no, they didn't seem concerned that anyone was going to come into the compound or that there's any interest or that anyone even knew we were there, really, was the main thing. So we'd arrived quite quietly and we were leaving quite quietly, and only certain people knew that we were there. So they seemed confident. And there were a lot of them as well, and they all had guns. So they're pretty nonchalant when it comes to their willingness to use violence. So I heard some shocking anecdotes from some of the guys that I was with about, you know, things that they'd done or things that they'd witnessed while living in this part of the world. So no, they were pretty relaxed.
I mean, like what?
Well, I mean, the fixer that I was with, he was from the same clan as a lot of the pirates. So that was kind of that was a lot of his work at that time, was putting Western journalists and other interested parties in touch with the pirates. So he had this really close connection with them. He was able to phone them up, you know, arrange meetings, that kind of thing. And he arranged a meeting between a friend of mine who's a filmmaker and the pirates a few months before I arrived. So what my friend wanted to do was go out onto a pirate ship, a ship that they had hijacked, and he wanted to film the hostages, so interview some of the hostages that were on board.
Oh, God.
And the pirates said yes to the interview, but they said no to him coming along. So they didn't want some random Western guy on their boat, or they didn't want him finding out where the boat was, essentially. So they took all the film gear and they took it out onto the hijacked vessel, and they did the filming and asked all the questions, and then they gave him the footage, which seemed fine. You know, that's pretty standard. The fixer guy I was with did that quite a lot. But unfortunately, what happened is, like, the day after that interview, the Puntland Naval Authorities attacked the vessel and took control of it and, you know, arrested a bunch of pirates and freed the hostages. So what the pirates thought was that the camera gear had some sort of GPS tracking device in it, and that they'd been set up, and the fixer had kind of made an arrangement with the authorities to get them arrested. And their reaction to this was to kidnap his brother. So they kidnapped his brother and took him off somewhere and charged some outrageous ransom to give his brother back. So the way he resolved this was to get all of his friends together and go and get as much firepower as they possibly could and head straight down to the shore and threaten to sink one of the pirates' vessels with an RPG unless they gave his brother back. And in the end, you know, Mexican standoff on the beach between two groups of guys armed to the teeth. And in the end, the pirates backed down and they gave his brother back and no one got hurt. But I just remember the kind of completely calm way that he told me this story. And I said, well, what would you have done if they hadn't given your brother back? And he just said, well, I would have killed them all. And, you know, just totally calm. He said, yeah, we just would have opened fire and, like, everyone would have died. But, well,
Oh my God!
Yeah, that's just the way things get resolved sometimes in that part of the world.
Well, it's interesting because I don't know the fellow you're talking about, but it would not surprise me at all if he was just, you know, I don't think that people in that state of mind are sociopathic or anything like that. It's clearly just like, it's almost like the hippos in the river. It's like, oh well, this is just a fact of life you got to deal with.
Yeah, I think it's just normalized. But I mean, I don't want to paint Somalia as being too dysfunctional. I mean, in many respects, they have mobile banking that works better than it does in the West. So for a lot of our traveling around, we obviously have to pay for different services and goods. And people are just getting their phones out and saying, oh, how much do I owe you for that? You know, tap a few buttons and bang, the money's there instantly.
Oh, wow.
And this is in a country with no 4G network, at least not back then. This is all done via text message, essentially. And money's just whirring around and everything works perfectly and it's instant. And I was amazed. You know, cash hardly ever changed hands. And wow. even when there was zero phone reception and there's no hope of even using that, the clan system that they have means that you can, I mean, it causes a lot of problems, but it also means that you can incur debt with each other and not worry about whether you're going to get repaid or not. So in a couple of instances, they kind of, you'd sit down and talk to the shopkeeper and say, okay, like, you know, we're from the same clan, so who do we know, who do we have in common? And then they talk about who their father and uncle and everyone was, and eventually go, oh, right, we both know this guy in this town. So if you give me this today, then my cousin will give your cousin this in 3 days' time in this place. And everything's just like, you know, all done on a handshake and it's all sorted.
Yeah, when I try that at Amazon, that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work at all. But yeah, that was really impressive. Like, so that aspect of the logistics was really, really smooth.
You also spent some time in Afghanistan, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So my friend and I went over to Afghanistan into the Wakhan Corridor, which is up in the Pamir Mountains in the northeast.
And what drew you there?
I suppose the valley is quite famous in terms of the landscape. It's quite a unique and beautiful landscape up in the mountains there. So I knew about it for quite a while. And then one of my friends was also interested in it for the same reason. So I think we just organized a trip one year and we went to Tajikistan, which is neighboring, and then we crossed over from the border into that section of Afghanistan.
I've always wanted to spend more time in the Middle East, but there's an impression that places like Afghanistan or Pakistan or you know, Iran, any of these places are just don't go, don't ever travel there. If you're an American, especially, they're gonna hate you. I mean, you've been in enough risky situations that I imagine you can smell danger pretty well at this point. Did you feel that way at all in Afghanistan?
Well, we knew it was risky. I mean, we went in 2011 or 2012. So there's a lot of fighting happening across the rest of the country.
Yeah.
But the Wakhan Corridor has a reputation of being one of the safer parts, simply because it's so isolated. So there's only one way in or out, and as long as the authorities have control of that, they can control who goes in or out of the corridor, because it's a narrow valley that goes all the way across the mountains, and then it ends up, you cross over there and you cross into China, and the Chinese have got very, very strong control over that part as well. And it's a big border with Pakistan, but that's very, very mountainous, so impermeable. There was an element of danger in the sense that the commander of the entrance to the valley was sending his troops. The day we crossed over, he sent a lot of his men over to go and fight the Taliban somewhere vaguely nearby. And he did kind of warn us. He did kind of warn us that it wasn't a very good idea coming over at this particular time. But he said as long as we were comfortable, then he was fine with having us there. So yeah, we went.
Nice. All this has shaped up into, I mean, you have a very,
I don't want to reduce this to a resume, but I mean, you have a very interesting resume. You're also working as a political risk and security consultant. What kinds of clients do you do work for?
It's highly varied. I mean, I work essentially as anyone who wants to travel or do business in the places that I cover. So my specialism is Africa, and specifically it's Lusophone Africa, so Portuguese-speaking Africa. So the majority of my clients are people who are working in either Angola or Mozambique. So it's NGOs, it's oil and gas companies, it's just businesses. Sometimes it's individuals, and it's really quite varied. Depends what they're doing, and how long they want to be there for.
How did you decide to start doing that? I mean, was this just something you realized you had a bunch of skills and you could, capitalize on that?
Well, I think it was kind of reverse engineering. So I remember, actually, this was in Sudan. So this was in 2006. I sat down and I thought, what jobs can I do that will pay me to continue traveling to all these places that I'm interested in? And I drew up a big list of those jobs. And three jobs that ended up on the list and that I actually ended up doing, one was travel writer, one was international school teacher, and the other one was political risk consultant. So even back in 2006, I realized that there was a potential to combine these things together to be able to continue traveling. And that's kind of what I did. So, I mean, it was quite easy for me to do research on teaching and how you get into teaching. So that was fine. And likewise with travel writing, you know, there's a lot of people out there willing to give advice on travel writing. It's a very popular career choice. The political risk thing was slightly more difficult, but I got quite lucky in that my mother's a language teacher, and she actually taught Italian to a political risk consultant, a security consultant. And so, you know, she kind of, he agreed to sit down with me, and we just sat down and he explained to me what it was that he did, who he did it for, and he had some suggestions for me for how I could get into the industry. So it kind of took it from there, basically.
This is kind of it has the potential to be an overgeneral question without any real answer, but I'm going to try to ask it anyway. The kinds of places you're going, the kind of life that you're living, which is my impression at least from this, you know, half hour plus conversation, is very independent, risk taking, but with preparation. Were you like this as a kid? What psychologically draws you to this?
I don't really know. No, I wasn't really like this as a kid. As I said, I never left Europe until I graduated from university. And I remember when I was at university, one of my best friends at the time, Mark, he used to do these crazy trips over the summer holidays. He'd go to all sorts of places. I think he went to Yemen once. He went to Iran. And I remember asking him at university, like, why? I just remember thinking it's so strange and unappealing. Just, why would you want to go to these terrible places? I remember saying that to him. It's quite embarrassing now. But I just asked him, why would you want to go there when you could go, you know, somewhere developed and safe and beautiful, like,
right,
you know, why not Portugal go to or Italy? Yeah, exactly. And I don't know what it was that he said exactly, but he must have persuaded me eventually, because I have been on quite a few trips with Mark since then to places like Yemen, and I just really enjoyed it. So I don't know what the change in mindset was, but I definitely have my friend to thank for it, at least in part.
Well, I wish you the best of luck on all your travels, and I think you're doing, amazing stuff. Before we go here, how can people find you?
Well, I have just started a new YouTube channel, which is Scafidi Travels. So it's just my name and then travels, so Scafidi. And what I'm doing at the moment is I am writing a travel guide to Tunisia over the course of this year, and I thought I'd film the whole process and put it as like a video diary on YouTube. So you can go and check it out at Scafidi Travels. And yeah, same on Twitter.
So this was a great conversation. Oscar, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you to Oscar Scafidi, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.